This is Please Explain. I'm Lisa Davies. A decision by the High Court last week to not deport two men of Aboriginal descent has set a precedent in recognising that the Indigenous connection to this land, Australia, is bigger than citizenship. So what does this mean for future cases and the debate about constitutional recognition? On this week's episode, I talked to Peter Harcher about the legal implications of last week's High Court ruling. Also, journalist and writer, Wiradjuri man Stan Grant, will share his feelings on the landmark decision. And later on in the episode, we'll check in with our two Indigenous journalists, Ella Archibald Binge and Rhett Wyman, who will tell us about the Dalarindji Project and share some of the stories they have discovered so far. But first, joining me is political editor and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, Peter Harcher. Peter, welcome back to Please Explain.
Happy to be here, Lisa.
Tell us about what happened in the High Court last week.
The High Court brought down a landmark judgment in the case of two fellows who had lived most of their lives in Australia, but had not taken Australian citizenship and were born overseas, one in Papua New Guinea, the other in New Zealand. They were both criminals, convicted criminals, who after serving their jail time, the federal government tried to deport. They took their case to the High Court, and their case was that they couldn't be deported because they were Aboriginal people. And so what the court established in its finding by a pretty narrow majority of 4-3, the High Court found that if you are in fact an Aboriginal person, even if you are not born in Australia, and even if you do not have Australian citizenship, you cannot be deported because you cannot be considered an alien under the Constitution, and that you have an inherent right to be here, which trumps the government's powers of deportation, and it also happens to create a new category of Australian citizen, and that is by recognising the inherent indigeneity of the Aboriginal people, finds that they have rights and entitlements to this country which predate British colonisation and still survive British colonisation. And in that sense, it's a direct descendant, really, from the Mabo case, the native title case from 1992, where the High Court then, in that case, found that there were indeed special, historic, and deep relationships between the Aboriginal people of Australia and their country, their lands, and their waters that pre-existed the British settlement and still survived. So this is really one of the implications, long delayed, from a 1992 case, the Mabo case, that now extends that principle, that finds that Aboriginal people do indeed have a unique and special place in Australia that is beyond the legislative reach of the federal parliament.
The implications of this judgment are potentially quite enormous. We've seen already some pretty strong responses from all sides, and you spoke to a couple of them for your column last week. Tell us a little bit, firstly, about how the politicians and how the government have responded.
The government's not happy with the High Court ruling. The government is still determined to try, they tell us, to try and find ways to deport these two fellows.
This is a decision of the High Court, obviously, and as people know, it was 4-3, so it was a fairly split decision, and the Chief Justice, I think, has made some very good points. I think there's significant repercussions, and essentially it creates another class of people, which I think is a very bad thing.
Peter Dutton has said that the ruling creates two classes of people in Australia, and that is a bad thing. I think that's a direct quote. Christian Porter said that he found it a very novel finding, to say the least, and that he agreed not with the majority, but that he agreed strongly with the minority. And the federal government would now look at the ruling in detail and see if there were other ways, if it could use other heads of power in the Constitution to try to achieve the same end. So they're going to try and manoeuvre around this finding and use another route to achieve the same outcome.
We will work through to see what sort of repercussions it might have in other areas.
The trick there could be, Lisa, that even if they do find another route, and constitutional scholar Anne Toomey says there are three potential openings for them to try that, even if they find another way to try and take it, to deport these guys, that will almost certainly end up back in the High Court, and that the High Court may again extend the same principle of establishing yet further rights that Indigenous Australians have that are beyond the reach of the Parliament further entrench the treatment of Aboriginal people under the Constitution as different to the treatment of everybody else, and end up not only frustrating the government's attempt at deportation, but in fact, by broadening the privileges and rights and recognition of Aboriginal Australia, further frustrate and anger the Conservatives who think this whole judgment is a very bad idea.
One of the thrusts of your column on the weekend was about how this may well arm Conservatives who already have very strong opposition to any formal constitutional recognition of Indigenous Australians. And of course, there are working groups and there's a process underway to look at what a referendum on this question might look like. How do you think this will play out in the minds and the actions of the Conservative politicians particularly?
Well, I think Anne Toomey's expression that it will spook a lot of people, in her view, is probably right, and we already see some signs of that. We see that from the IPA, we see that in some of the Conservative newspaper columns, and we have hints of that in Peter Dutton and Christian Porter's responses. What we can expect is that, to use the words of Father Frank Brennan, Father Frank Brennan is a noted jurist. He's the Jesuit priest who's also spent most of his life devoted to Aboriginal rights and Aboriginal justice. But in his words, this will give the Conservatives a cause. This will give the Conservatives a new opportunity to latch onto and a new argument to say, look, we have to stop this, that the Constitution makes no mention of Aboriginal Australians. And yet somehow the High Court has managed not only to identify them as separate, but to classify them as beyond the reach of Parliament in some ways, and to create this whole new category of rights. And therefore, where is this madness going to stop? So we have to stop it now. No more voice to Parliament, no concept of constitutional recognition beyond what the High Court's already done. And I think Frank's fears are already being borne out in some of the responses we see.
At the moment, it's a difficult time for the Prime Minister. He's coming off the back of a summer in which he was resoundingly criticised for his inaction over the bushfires, and it's been a reasonably torrid start to the year, it could be argued. This is not the time that he really wants to be fighting this battle, is it?
No, it's not. Morrison, I think, is still really coming to grasp and appreciate the depth of the political problem he created for himself with his very serious misjudgment of the national crisis that was the fire, drought, followed by flooding. And he is in a deep deficit now that he was not. Most Australians didn't know much about Morrison and didn't care much, except that they knew he'd become Prime Minister, and many voted for him. But the strongest first impression that many people now have of Morrison is the man who took a secret holiday to Hawaii when he should have been leading a national response. So, you're right, he doesn't want any more fights with the public. He doesn't want any more fights, especially with his own party room, and even where those two come into conflict. So that's now over energy and climate change policy. What's Morrison do where he sees the public needs, demands, in fact, movement on climate and energy policy on the one hand, and that he still has a resistance rump in the form of the National Party and some of his other conservative liberals? What's he do about that? Well, what he's doing about that is very quietly tiptoeing carefully and cautiously away from the previous 10-year policy of the Liberals towards a new one. But he's doing it, he's trying to do it very delicately so that he does it without starting an insurrection in his own party. So this is the big game for him. Secondary fights, like, you know, whether there is or isn't an Aboriginal voice, are really going to be very much, as you imply, at the very, very tail end of his agenda, and I don't think it's going to be any sort of progress this term of Parliament as a result of all this.
All right. Thank you very much, Peter.
Pleasure, Lisa.
You're listening to Please Explain. Coming up, I'll be talking to journalist Dan Grant. Dan Grant, welcome back to Please Explain.
Lisa, good to be here.
In a majority decision last week, the High Court effectively found that Indigenous connection to this land, to Australia, is bigger than citizenship. How did that make you feel?
It made me feel, well, first of all, it's telling us something we've already known. We are from here. We are not from somewhere else. And, you know, 60,000 years of connection to this place means something. Our civilization, our languages, our culture, our customs, our identities, our kinship. Born here. We are from this land. When I go to my country, to my mother's country, my father's country, when I stand on that land, I'm connected to something that is much bigger than 200 years, much bigger than federation, much bigger than a constitution. And what we're seeing now is that the courts are grappling with this. They're trying to come to terms with our antiquity and the rights that flow from that in an environment where there is no political architecture that deals with those rights. No treaties, no formal recognition of self-determination. It is not like New Zealand. It is not like Canada. It is not like the United States. So in that political vacuum, our courts are trying to interpret what antiquity and connection and culture and ongoing connection to country means in the face of a history of exclusion and a political system that was imposed on us. It made me proud to be Australian that our courts and our legal system can find a way through this, but at the same time reminded us of just how much of opposition we face to the very idea that Aboriginal people have an ongoing enduring sovereignty to this country which predates British settlement and survives it.
And that backlash has been coming from a number of quarters. The government has indicated they're going to look to sidestep the decision, perhaps with legislation, and there have been calls to change for the makeup of the High Court, more conservative appointments, even though they are conservative appointments, two of the majority judges. And of course, condemnation that race has somehow been brought into this decision. What do you make of these responses?
Well, first of all, let's deal with the question of race. I mean, you find a lot of people who are critical of these types of judgments, critical going back to the 1992 Mabo judgment as well. Remember when that came out? This is going to change Australia forever. We must extinguish this. We must remove these people's rights. This is changing the nature of Australia. It's creating two categories of Australians. We always see this opposition on the basis of race, which is blind to a history of this country that is formulated out of the idea of race. When you steal another people's land on the basis that that race of people have no inherent rights to this land, when you can deem a country to be empty because you don't recognise the rights of the people who are here, don't tell me now that race is not built into the foundation of this country. When the very first act of Parliament after Federation is to set up a law that became known as the White Australia Policy, and tell me now that race is not part of the fabric of this country, to tell us that you can write a constitution that says, for the purposes of reckoning the numbers of the people of the Commonwealth, Aboriginal natives will not be counted, and tell me that that is not about race, to tell me that you can't set up a section of the constitution, section 5126, that initially said the parliament has the right to make the laws for the people of any race other than Aboriginal people, and then to amend that in 1967 to say that the parliament has the right to make laws for the people of any race, and that is applied only to Aboriginal people, to then sit around and make some argument, some straw man argument, that the court is now implanting race in the constitution when race has always been there, it is nonsense. What the court is trying to do is unravel the idea of race. How do we unravel a constitution and a political legacy and an historical legacy that has always privileged white race over all other races? I also want to attack this idea that Aboriginal people are seen as a race. You know, race as a scientific notion is completely debunked. The idea of race is a product of racism. Racism establishes race for the purposes of entrenching power over other people via slavery or colonization or whatever that may be. We are a people. We are a member of the human race, and we are a unique people from this land. And as a people, we have rights. But they hide behind race as a way of muddying the waters to now say that race is creating two types of people in this country when race has always been at the heart of the Australian experiment. And then, of course, you know, you get the other argument that, well, this is ultimately going to be damaging to Aboriginal people because we can't separate Australians. Well, you know, we are a people and a sovereign people. We should have the right to protect as much of that sovereignty as possible within the sovereignty of the Commonwealth, and to negotiate that and to dispute that and to prosecute that through our courts and our politics the same way that anyone else can.
In an opinion piece you wrote for The Herald and The Age on Tuesday, you wrote, "A nation can't run from itself forever. How we respond to this moment will determine whether we can truly be a nation steeped in 60,000 years of tradition or one wrapped in 200 years of whiteness." Listening to you today and reading those words, do I sense some anger? Are you angry?
You know, the anger is always there, Lisa. I have always felt anger about this. I felt anger when I was a boy, growing up, and looking at the circumstances that we lived in. You know, we knew who we were. We knew we were where we were because of who we were. History had placed us there. I saw the way my family were treated. I saw the way we had to live. You know, I grew up with the stories of my mother and my father telling us about beatings that my father took at the hands of police, of my grandfather tied up and chained to a tree like a dog because he was accused of drinking alcohol, of my mother's mother, a white woman, turned away from a hospital giving birth to her children because she was having the children of an Aboriginal man. I mean, this is our history. This is who we are. I live with that anger all the time. All Aboriginal people live with this anger. And then we have the salt rubbed into the wounds by people who then dispute our rights in this country when the highest court in the land, a product of the British civilization and British legal system that is so exalted by conservatives, when they deign to recognise our rights, we then have salt rubbed into the wounds by being attacked again and forced to defend what the High Court says are our rights. I'm very angry about those things. I'm angry that we are constantly denied and let down by a political process that has never been able to see us as a people in our own right. I was a member of the Referendum Council, tasked with going around Australia, canvassing the opinions of Aboriginal people, reaching a consensus about what meaningful constitutional recognition would look like. The Uluru Statement from the Heart carried on the voices of Aboriginal people saying, this is what we want, not symbolic recognition, but something meaningful that brings about real change and recognises our sovereignty shared within the sovereignty of the Commonwealth, rejected out of hand. And then we were told to go back to the table and negotiate again. At what point do you get sick of that? And I think from my point of view now, it is saying, this is who we are. This is where we are from. We know who we are. We have a right to hold to those things that are important to us and to not yield to people who want to beat us down and compromise us out of existence.
Do you have any optimism about what might happen now?
I always have optimism about the capacity of our people to endure. You know, and I wrote about my father the other day in the Sydney Morning Herald. This is someone who has been told at every turn since he was born that he didn't have a rightful place in this country, whose language Australia tried to silence, who at various times has been locked up and beaten up, who didn't have access to a full education, who has done nothing but live on his land, speaking his language, practicing his culture, and sharing that with other people, that in spite of everything, he has a generosity that comes from knowing who he is on the land that he was raised in, the land of his ancestors, a generosity that says in spite of everything, he can connect that and open that up to non-Indigenous people. We're the ones who are saying, connect to this country through us, that 200 years of British settlement connects to 60,000 years of settlement and occupation and ownership of this country. Australia doesn't begin with Captain Cook. It doesn't begin with the First Fleet. It doesn't begin with Federation. All of that enters into a heritage that was already here. And that's the challenge for Australia. What are we going to be? Are we going to be a country that recognises that there is a depth of connection and antiquity here that makes us unique and that that forms the bedrock of this country? Or are we going to be a country that says the act of British settlement extinguished all of that? You know, we look across at New Zealand. And New Zealand is founded in the Treaty of Waitangi. First the treaty, then the acknowledgement of the Commonwealth, the sovereignty of New Zealand. And when they signed the treaty, Governor Hobson, in Maori language, was able to say, now we are one people. And we can't say that in Australia.
Really appreciate your time, and I'm sure we'll speak again. Thanks, Dan.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Please Explain. I'm Lisa Davies. Very soon, Ella Archibald Binge and Rhett Wyman will tell us about their work on the Dalarindji project.
From the team that brought you Phoebe's Fall and Wrong Skin comes a new 10-part investigative podcast.
Motor, vessel, Pong, Sue, I intend to board you.
I thought to myself, this is this f***ing boat.
The last voyage of the Pong Sue is a story of drugs, cops, espionage, military, death, a dictator and mateship.
Flag of my honour is Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
150 kilos of heroin had never been imported before.
These people, they expected to be executed.
It's a dead person.
Holy shit.
Search for The Last Voyage of the Pong Sue on your favourite podcast app.
Ella and Rhett, thanks for joining me on Please Explain. So, ladies first, Ella, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you've ended up at the Herald.
I'm a Kamilaroi woman on my dad's side, so I'm a descendant of the Kamilaroi people from northwestern New South Wales. My grandfather grew up on the mission around Toomala, Bogabilla, but I myself grew up just on the Queensland side of the border in Stanthorpe, a little country town. And that's where I started my journalism career with a cadetship at the local paper, which was, the last place I expected to end up after uni, but ended up being a really formative experience. And then went from Stanthorpe to Sydney to do a cadetship with SBS NITV. Kept working with NITV, the Indigenous broadcaster, sort of in a variety of roles in Sydney and then later back in Brisbane, a bit closer to home, kind of covering Indigenous affairs issues across the state up there. And yeah, just started here a few months ago and I'm loving it so far.
And Rhett, you're a Palawa man from Tasmania. And while you've been working in photography for a little while now, this is your first job in a newsroom. How are you finding it?
It's been an amazing experience so far. It's been a steep learning curve as well, but I love the daily life of meeting new people and problem solving. So yeah, every day is different.
Together, you're working on a 12-month project, which comes with the support of the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas. And you'll be documenting the lives of First Nations people. Ella, tell the listeners a little bit about what we're calling the Dalarindji Project.
So Dalarindji is a language word. It's the language of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation here in Sydney. And it basically means ours, yours and everyone's. So we're kind of framing this project as an invitation to all Australians to really celebrate the living culture that's at the heart of our nation and also to take a deeper look at those issues affecting Indigenous people. So yeah, I guess it's this idea that this is all of our shared heritage that we should be really proud of, and also we should all be concerned about these ongoing issues as well.
You've both been with us for about 3 months now, but the most recent trip that you took was the biggest and so far the most important. So why Cape York?
So I suppose I'd spent quite a bit of time travelling to various communities around Queensland in my previous role. We went to specifically Lockhart River, so that's a very tiny community, only 700 people. It's sort of just across the Cape from Aurukun, and we're talking it's like 10-hour drive from Cairns if you were brave enough to drive it, which is only an option for half of the year when the roads are dry. But basically, I'd heard good things about Lockhart River from a variety of people throughout my travels, and it seemed like a good example because it was so remote. The challenges there were, you know, were really tough, and they've been around for a long time, and they're challenges that have faced, you know, each community is different, but some of these challenges are similar to a lot of these remote areas. But it was one where there is really strong local leadership, where the community had really stepped up to try to make their own solutions, to make them happen. So we did want to show examples of that because I know that that's a common theme and that, you know, every community has its issues, but every community, you know, has really strong leaders that are making a difference. So that was something we really wanted to highlight, yeah.
And you mentioned you've been there a bit before. Rhett, have you ever been up there?
For the first 8 years of my life, I spent them school holidays on Atherton Tablelands, yeah. And I'd been as far as Cape Tribulation, but I'd never gone as far as Lockhart River. I'd always dreamed of it. But yeah, it was definitely an experience.
And what sort of things did you have to do in preparation to make sure that, I mean, you're walking into a community that has been, I guess, portrayed not always in the best light, and not that you're trying to portray it in a good light, you know, for that, for the sake of it, but what are the sort of things in terms of preparation that going there that you thought about?
There definitely is a level of mistrust towards the media from a lot of Aboriginal communities. Often, as you say, there are stories that are maybe coming from a negative mindset without even realising it. People are coming in with these preconceived ideas about what these communities look like and the challenges that people are facing there. So I guess it was a major challenge for us. We sort of spent almost the first 2 days just trying to explain to people what we were doing. You know, people don't know the Sydney Morning Herald in this, you know, tiny corner of the world. But, you know, we did spend a lot of time trying to explain what we were doing. And as you say, it's not about glossing over the issues, and no one up there wants to do that. They want people to know the reality that they're facing. But it's about coming at it, I guess, with the perspective of putting the community front and centre and trying to get across some of the positive work that is being done, because I think it's just not useful to come in and just, you know, shine a spotlight on all the issues and not look at why are things like this, what can be done to help, you know, make positive change, and how are people already doing that?
So in addition to collecting a variety of stories, of which we've published already, one of the things we talked about before you going was being able to sort of bring to life the annual Closing the Gap report. So for listeners who don't know, since about 2008, the Prime Minister has read a report on a number of key metrics for the Indigenous community, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities in Australia, and tracking progress is basically and having that accountability to the nation's parliament. Tell us about the Lockhart River, Ella, and what they're doing there that provided that great window into what is otherwise just statistics and rhetoric, basically.
So basically we wanted to take that, you know, this is something I've reported on every year for the last 6 odd years, and we wanted to take the sort of talking heads in Canberra and a lot of the statistics, which we kind of hear the same stuff over and over again, and I think sometimes that can lose impact. So we wanted to take this, you know, to a community. What does this look like for someone on the ground? And what needs to happen, you know, from their perspective. But I guess what we found is that there had definitely been a lot of frustration, and probably still is, from that particular community about people flying in with the answers, you know, every so often whenever there's a new government, and kind of saying, all right, here's what we're going to do for you. They had had enough of that. And around the same time that that strategy was launched in 2008, they sort of launched their own foundation to try to make some of these changes themselves, to sort of get in the driver's seat and say, this is what we want. We're just going to try to do it the best we can with the resources available, which is where the issue comes in. Basically, this community has decided that it's really wanting to invest in its youth through a variety of programs that they've sort of taken it upon themselves to get up and running, a childcare centre, more maternal health programs to try to look after mothers and, you know, children in the womb through to early childhood, and getting them on the right path with schooling and that sort of thing. But I think what we found was the frustration came in that even when they could prove that these things were working, or that, you know, people had great ideas that they wanted to make happen, you know, local small businesses, things like that, they just weren't getting the prolonged support from government. And, you know, they wanted to be empowered to do these things, especially when they've got the figures, you know, to show, hey, this is working. But yet they were still struggling to get that ongoing support from government beyond, you know, one election cycle.
And it was certainly a really great addition to our coverage of what, as you say, it has always just been sort of numbers and speech in parliament from both the Prime Minister and the opposition leader. Rhett, a lot of your photos do show, I think, that sense of hope and some sort of optimism there. Is that what you experienced, and were you looking for that in particular, do you think?
I was looking for it, but it sort of just presented itself as well. Yeah, the people that I did end up photographing were, you know, very excited, and they were happy to be in community, and yeah, they were happy to show what it was like to be there and how these programs are actually working. So we were working closely with the medical centre and the childcare and that, and I think the systems they've got in place, they seem to be working, and hence I think why people are optimistic.
Yeah, there's, for those listeners who haven't had a look, it's worth checking out because it's not the usual kind of story that people might be familiar with from that part of the world. Let's just talk quickly about some of the other stories you've done. You've been covered a range of issues already. What have been your favourite story each that you've worked on, Rhett?
Probably would have to be the Waterloo Creek Massacre just outside of Moree. So that was on the 26th of January, so in 1838. It was specific to a, you know, certain time and so forth, and we were able to experience it.
And I think that community is particularly, when we're talking about trust and, you know, negative portrayals of communities, Moree is one that has copped a fair bit of negative attention over the years. So, and, it, you know, for me as well, that's my country. You know, my pop grew up on the mission not far from there. And a lot of the people I was talking to, you know, were relatives of mine, and I was able to learn a bit out there, which is an amazing experience. But also once they understood what we were doing with this project, they knew about both of our heritage, that sort of, you know, opened up doors for us with that story as well. They were very trusting. They were very happy to take us out to the site of this massacre and spend, you know, a good bit of time with us, which was really special.
And you, Ellie, do you have a different favourite?
Yeah, I mean, definitely that had a personal significance for me. I think one of the other ones that's been really moving for both of us was to do with cultural burning. So this was kind of in the middle of the bushfire crisis, and I think people were kind of really keen for anything that was a little bit optimistic or to grab onto a bit of hope. And we sort of did this story with some property owners out near the Hunter Valley who basically had done some cultural burning around their property, which is kind of like a cooler version of hazard reduction burns. It's a lot more complicated than that, but that's a very simplified version, but obviously a traditional practice dating back tens of thousands of years. And they'd basically said that that, at least in part, was, you know, credited that with saving their home. And just the reaction to that was really, really interesting, and I think caught everyone by surprise. Like, I was getting, you know, journalists from Scotland and from France, and still am, you know, getting people. There's so much international and national interest in looking at this sort of thing, I think, tapping into that traditional knowledge for land management and all sorts of things.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us. We are going to be talking to you hopefully a lot more over the course of this 12-month project, and hopefully you'll be with us a lot longer than just the 12 months. Thanks so much to our Please Explain guests this week, Ella Archibald Binge and Rhett Wyman, and Peter Hartcher from the Sydney Morning Herald, and journalist Dan Grant. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe, Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. If you're a fan of the show, like or review us on iTunes. It helps others find out about this podcast. This episode of Please Explain was produced and edited by Leah Samoglu. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Lisa Davies. Thanks for listening.